randier than a sailor on a three-day shore leave. Richard is usually there waiting for me, ready to start laughing. He always teases me with the same line when he sees my confounded and exhausted face. Think you'll ever amount to anything, groceries? But this morning in meditation, after I heard the lion roar, "You have no idea how strong my love is," I came out of that meditation cave like a warrior queen. Richard didn't even have time to ask if I thought I'd ever amount to anything in this life before I looked him eye to eye and said, "I already have, mister." "Check you out," Richard said. "This is cause for celebration. Come on, kiddo. I'll take you into town and buy you a thumbs up." Thumbs up is an Indian soft drink, sort of like Coca-Cola, but with about 9 times the corn syrup and triple that of caffeine. I think it might have methamphetamines in it, too. It makes me see double. A few times a week, Richard and I wander into town and share one small bottle of Thumbs Up, a radical experience after the purity of vegetarian ashram food, always being careful to not actually touch the bottle with our lips. Richard's rule about traveling in India is a sound one. Don't touch anything but yourself. And yes, that was also a tentative title for this book. We have our favorite visits in town, always stopping to pay respects to the temple and to say hello to Mr. Panakar, the tailor, who shakes our hands and says, "Congratulations to meet you," every time. We watch the cows mill about, enjoying their sacred status. I think they actually abuse the privilege, lying right there in the middle of the road just to drive home the point that they are holy. And we watch the dogs scratch themselves like they're wondering how the heck they ever ended up here. We watch the women doing road work, busting up rocks under the sweltering sun, swinging sledgehammers, barefoot, looking so strangely beautiful in their jewel-colored saris and their necklaces and bracelets. They give us dazzling smiles, which I can't begin to understand. How can they be happy doing this rough work under such terrible conditions? Why don't they all faint and die after 15 minutes in the boiling heat with those sledgehammers? I ask Mr. Panakar, the tailor, about it, and he says it's like this with the villagers, that people in this part of the world were born to this kind of hard labor, and work is all they are used to. "Also," he adds casually, "we don't live very long around here." It's a poor village, of course, but not desperate by the standards of India. The presence and charity of the ashram and some Western currency floating around makes a significant difference. Not that there's so much to buy here, though Richard and I like to look around in all the shops that sell the beads and the little statues. There are some Kashmiri guys, very shrewd salesmen indeed, who are always trying to unload their wares on us. One of them really came after me today, asking if Madam would perhaps like to buy a fine Kashmiri rug for her home. This made Richard laugh. He enjoys, among other sports, making fun of me for being homeless. "Save your breath, brother," he said to the rug salesman. "This old girl ain't got any floors to put a rug on." Undaunted, the Kashmiri salesman suggested, "Then perhaps Madam would like to hang a rug on her wall?" "See now," said Richard, "that's the thing. She's a little short on walls these days, too." "But I have a brave heart," I piped up in my own defense. "And other sterling qualities," added Richard, tossing me a bone for once in his life. 52. The biggest obstacle in my ashram experience is not meditation, actually. That's difficult, of course, but not murderous. There's something even harder for me here. The murderous thing is what we do every morning after meditation and before breakfast. My God, but these mornings are long. A chant called the Guru Gita. Richard calls it the Geet. I have so much trouble with the Geet. I do not like it at all, never have, not since the first time I heard it sung in the ashram in upstate New York. I like all the other chants and hymns of this yogic tradition, but the Guru Gita feels long, tedious, sonorous, and insufferable. That's just my opinion, of course. Other people claim to love it, though I can't fathom why. The Guru Gita is 182 verses long for crying out loud, and sometimes I do, and each verse is a paragraph of impenetrable Sanskrit. Together with the preamble chant and the wrap-up chorus, the entire ritual takes about an hour and a half to perform. This is before breakfast, remember, and after we have already had an hour of meditation and a 20-minute chanting of the first morning hymn. The Guru Gita is basically the reason you have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning around here. I don't like the tune, and I don't like the words. Whenever I tell anyone around the ashram this, they say, "Oh, but it's so sacred." Yes, but so is the Book of Job, and I don't choose to sing the thing aloud every morning before breakfast. The Guru Gita does have an impressive spiritual lineage. It's an excerpt from a holy ancient scripture of yoga called the Skanda Purana, most of which has been lost, and little of which has been translated out of Sanskrit. Like most of yogic scripture, it's written in the form of a conversation, an almost Socratic dialogue. The conversation is between the goddess Parvati and the almighty, all-encompassing god Shiva. Parvati and Shiva are the divine embodiment of creativity, the feminine, and consciousness, the masculine. She is the generated energy of the universe. He is its formless wisdom. Whatever Shiva imagines, Parvati brings to life. He dreams it, she materializes it. Their dance, their union, their yoga is both the cause of the universe and its manifestation. In the Guru Gita, the goddess is asking the god for the secrets of worldly fulfillment, and he is telling her. It bugs me, this hymn. I had hoped my feelings about the Guru Gita would change during my stay at the ashram. I'd hoped that putting it in an Indian context would cause me to learn how to love the thing. In fact, the opposite has happened. Over the few weeks that I've been here, my feelings about the Guru Gita have shifted from simple dislike to solid dread. I've started skipping it and doing other things with my morning that I think are much better for my spiritual growth, like writing in my journal, or taking a shower, or calling my sister back in Pennsylvania and seeing how her kids are doing. Richard from Texas always busts me for skipping out. "I notice you're absent from the Geet this morning," he'll say. And I'll say, "I am communicating with God in other ways," and he'll say, "By sleeping in, you mean?" But when I try to go to the chant, all it does is agitate me. I mean physically. I don't feel like I'm singing it so much as being dragged behind it. It makes me sweat. And this is odd because I tend to be one of life's chronically cold people, and it's cold in this part of India in January before the sun comes up. Everyone else sits in the chant, huddled in wool blankets and hats to stay warm, and I'm peeling layers off myself as the hymn drones on, foaming like an overworked farm horse. I come out of the temple after the Guru Gita, and the sweat rises off my skin in the cold morning air like fog, like horrible, green, stinky fog. The physical reaction is mild compared to the hot waves of emotion that rock me as I try to sing the thing, and I can't even sing it. I can only croak it, resentfully. Did I mention it has 182 verses? So a few days ago, after a particularly yucky session of chanting, I decided to seek advice from my favorite teacher around here, a monk with a wonderfully long Sanskrit name, which translates as, "He who dwells in the heart of the Lord who dwells within his own heart." This monk is American, in his 60s, smart and educated. He used to be a classical theater professor at NYU, and he still carries himself with a rather venerable dignity. He took his monastic vows almost 30 years ago. I like him because he's no-nonsense and funny. In a dark moment of confusion about David, I'd once confided my heartache to this monk. He listened respectfully, offered up the most compassionate advice he could find, and then said, "And now I'm kissing my robes." He lifted a corner of his saffron robes and gave a loud smack. Thinking this was probably some super arcane religious custom, I asked what he was doing. He said, "Same thing I always do whenever anyone comes to me for relationship advice. I'm just thanking God I'm a monk and I don't have to deal with this stuff anymore." So I knew I could trust him to let me speak frankly about my problems with the Guru Gita. We went for a walk in the gardens together one night after dinner, and I told him how much I disliked the thing and asked if he could please excuse me from having to sing it anymore. He immediately started laughing. He said, "You don't have to sing it if you don't want to. Nobody around here is ever going to make you do anything you don't want to do." "But people say it's a vital spiritual practice." "It is. But I'm not going to tell you that you're going to go to hell if you don't do it. The only thing I'll tell you is that your guru has been very clear about this. The Guru Gita is the one essential text of this yoga, and maybe the most important practice you can do next to meditation. If you're staying at the ashram, she expects you to get up for the chant every morning." It's not that I mind getting up early in the morning. What is it then? I explained to the monk why I had come to dread the Guru Gita, how torturous it feels. He said, "Wow, look at you. Even just talking about it, you're getting all bent out of shape." It was true. I could feel cold, clammy sweat accumulating in my armpits. I asked, "Can't I use that time to do other practices instead? I find sometimes that if I go to the meditation cave during the Guru Gita, I can get a nice vibe going for meditation.
Ah, Swamiji would have yelled at you for that. He would have called you a chanting thief for riding on the energy of everybody else's hard work.
Look, the Guru Gita isn't supposed to be a fun song to sing. It has a different function. It's a text of unimaginable power. It is a mighty purifying practice. It burns away all your junk, all your negative emotions. And I think it's probably having a positive effect on you if you're experiencing such strong emotions and physical reactions while you're chanting it. This stuff can be painful, but it's awfully beneficial. How do you keep the motivation to stay with it?
What's the alternative? To quit whenever something gets challenging? To futz around your whole life, miserable and incomplete?
Did you really just say futz around?
Yes. Yes, I did.
What should I do?
You have to decide for yourself.
But my advice, since you asked, is that you stick to chanting the Guru Gita while you're here, especially because you're having such an extreme reaction to it. If something is rubbing so hard against you, you can be sure it's working on you. This is what the Guru Gita does. It burns away the ego, turns you into pure ash. It's supposed to be arduous, Liz. It has power beyond what can be rationally understood. You're only staying at the ashram another week, right? And then you're free to go traveling and have fun. So just chant the thing 7 more times, and then you never have to do it again. Remember what our guru says. Be a scientist of your own spiritual experience. You're not here as a tourist or a journalist. You're here as a seeker, so explore it.
So you're not letting me off the hook?
You can let yourself off the hook anytime you want, Liz. That's the divine contract of a little something we call free will. 53. So I went to the chant the next morning, all full of resolve, and the Guru Gita kicked me down a 20-foot flight of cement stairs. Or anyway, that's how it felt. The next day, it was even worse. I woke up in a fury, and before I even got to the temple, I was already sweating, boiling, teeming. I kept thinking, it's only an hour and a half. You can do anything for an hour and a half. For God's sake, you have friends who are in labor for 14 hours. But still, I could not have been less comfortable in this chair if I had been stapled to it. I kept feeling fireballs of, like, menopausal heat pulsing over me, and I thought I might faint or bite somebody in my fury. My anger was giant. It took in everyone in this world, but it was most specifically directed at Swamiji, my guru's master, who had instituted this ritual chanting of the Guru Gita in the first place. This was not my first difficult encounter with the great and now deceased yogi. He was the one who had come to me in my dream on the beach, demanding to know how I intended to stop the tide. And I always felt like he was riding me. Swamiji had been all throughout his life relentless, a spiritual firebrand. Like St. Francis of Assisi, Swamiji had been born into a wealthy family and had been expected to enter the family business. But when he was just a young boy, he met a holy man in a small village near his and had been deeply touched by the experience. Still in his teens, Swamiji left home in a loincloth and spent years making pilgrimages to every holy spot in India, searching for a true spiritual master. He was said to have met over 60 saints and gurus, never finding the teacher he wanted. He starved, wandered on foot, slept outside in Himalayan snowstorms, suffered from malaria, dysentery, and called these the happiest years of his life, just searching for somebody who would show God to him. Over those years, Swamiji became a hatha yogi, an expert in Ayurvedic medicine and cooking, an architect, a gardener, a musician, and a sword fighter. This I love. By his middle years, he had still not found a guru, until one day he encountered a mad, naked sage who told him to go back home, back to the village where he had met the holy man as a child, and to study with that great saint. Swamiji obeyed, returned home, and became the holy man's most devoted student, finally achieving enlightenment through his master's guidance. Ultimately, Swamiji would become a guru himself. Over time, his ashram in India grew from 3 rooms on a barren farm to the lush garden it is today. Then he got the inspiration to go traveling and incite a worldwide meditation revolution.
He came to America in 1970 and blew everybody's mind. He gave divine initiation, Shaktipat, to hundreds and thousands of people a day. He had a power that was immediate and transformative. The Reverend Eugene Callender, a respected civil rights leader, a colleague of Martin Luther King Jr., and still the pastor of a Baptist church in Harlem, remembers meeting Swamiji in the 1970s and dropping on his knees before the Indian man in amazement and thinking to himself, "There's no time for shucking and jiving now. This is it. This man knows everything there is to know about you." Swamiji demanded enthusiasm, commitment, self-control. He was always scolding people for being jad, the Hindi word for inert. He brought ancient concepts of discipline to the lives of his often rebellious young Western followers, commanding them to stop wasting their own and everyone else's time and energy with their freewheeling hippie nonsense. He would throw his walking stick at you one minute, hug you the next. He was complicated, often controversial, but truly world-changing. The reason we have access now in the West to so many ancient yogic scriptures is that Swamiji presided over the translation and revitalization of philosophical texts that had long been forgotten, even in much of India. My guru was Swamiji's most devoted student. She was literally born to be his disciple. Her Indian parents were amongst his earliest followers. When she was only a child, she would often chant for 18 hours a day, tireless in her devotion. Swamiji recognized her potential, and he took her on when she was still a teenager to be his translator. She traveled all over the world with him, paying such close attention to her guru, she said later, that she could even feel him speaking to her with his knees. She became his successor in 1982, still in her 20s. All true gurus are alike in the fact that they exist in a constant state of self-realization, but external characteristics differ. The apparent differences between my guru and her master are vast. She's a feminine, multilingual, university-educated, and savvy professional woman. He was a sometimes capricious, sometimes kingly, South Indian old lion. For a nice New England girl like me, it is easy to follow my living teacher, who is so reassuring in her propriety, exactly the kind of guru you could take home to meet Mom and Dad. But Swamiji, he was such a wild card. And from the first time I came to this yogic path and saw photographs of him and heard stories about him, I thought, I'm just going to stay clear of this character. He's too big. He makes me nervous. But now that I am here in India, here in the ashram that was his home, I'm finding that all I want is Swamiji. All I feel is Swamiji. The only person I talk to in my prayers and meditations is Swamiji. It's the Swamiji channel, round the clock. I am in the furnace of Swamiji here, and I can feel him working on me. Even in his death, there's something so earthy and present about him. He's the master I need when I'm really struggling, because I can curse him and show him all my failures and flaws, and all he does is laugh. Laugh and love me. His laughter makes me angrier, and the anger motivates me to act. And I never feel closer to him than when I'm struggling through the Guru Gita, with its unfathomable Sanskrit verses. I'm arguing with Swamiji the whole time in my head, making all kinds of blowhard proclamations like, "You better be doing something for me because I'm doing this for you. I better see some results here. This better be purifying." Yesterday, I got so incensed when I looked down at my chanting book and realized we were only on verse 25, and I was already burning in discomfort, already sweating, and not like a person sweats either, but rather like a cheese sweats, that I actually expelled aloud, "You gotta be kidding me!" And a few women turned and looked at me in alarm, expecting, no doubt, to see my head start spinning demonically on my neck. Every once in a while, I recall that I used to live in Rome, and spend my leisurely mornings eating pastries and drinking cappuccino and reading the newspaper. That sure was nice, though it seems very far away now. 54. This morning I overslept. Which is to say, sloth that I am, I dozed until the ungodly hour of 4:15 a.m. I woke up only minutes before the Guru Gita was about to begin, motivated myself reluctantly to get out of bed, splashed some water on my face, dressed, and feeling so crusty and cranky and resentful, went to leave my room in the pre-dawn pitch black, only to find that my roommate had left the room before me and had locked me in. This was a really difficult thing for her to have done. It's not that big a room, and it's hard not to notice that your roommate is still sleeping in the next bed. And she's a really responsible, practical woman, a mother of five from Australia. This is not her style, but she did it. She literally padlocked me in the room. My first thought was, if there were ever a good excuse not to go to the Guru Gita, this would be it. My second thought, though? Well, it wasn't even a thought. It was an action. I jumped out of the window. To be specific, I crawled outside over the railing, gripping it with my sweaty palms and dangling there two stories up over the darkness for a moment, only then asking myself the reasonable question, why are you jumping out of this building? My reply came with a fierce, impersonal determination. I have to get to the Guru Gita. Then I let go and dropped backward, maybe 12 or 15 feet through the dark air to the concrete sidewalk below, hitting something on the way down that peeled a long strip of skin off my right shin, but I didn't care. I picked myself up and ran barefoot, my pulse slamming in my ears, all the way to the temple, found a seat, opened up my prayer book just as the chant was beginning, and, bleeding down my leg the whole while, I started to sing the Guru Gita. It was only after a few verses that I caught my breath and was able to think my normal instinctive morning thought. I don't want to be here. After which I heard Swamiji burst out laughing in my head, saying, "That's funny. You sure act like somebody who wants to be here." And I replied to him, "Okay then. You win." I sat there, singing and bleeding, and thinking that maybe it was time for me to change my relationship with this particular spiritual practice. The Guru Gita is meant to be a hymn of pure love, but something had been stopping me short from offering up that love in sincerity. So as I chanted each verse, I realized that I needed to find something or somebody to whom I could devote this hymn in order to find a place of pure love within me. By verse 20, I had it. Nick. Nick, my nephew, is an 8-year-old boy. Skinny for his age, scarily smart, frighteningly astute, sensitive, and complex. Even minutes after his birth, amid all the squalling newborns in the nursery, he alone was not crying, but looking around with adult, worldly, and worried eyes, looking as though he'd done all this before so many times and wasn't sure how excited he felt about having to do it again. This is a child for whom life is never simple, a child who hears and sees and feels everything intensely, a child who can be overcome by emotions so fast sometimes that it unnerves us all. I love this boy so deeply and protectively. I realized, doing the math on the time difference between India and Pennsylvania, that it was nearing his bedtime back home. So I sang the Guru Gita to my nephew Nick to help him sleep. Sometimes he has trouble sleeping because he cannot still his mind. So each devotional word of this hymn I dedicated to Nick. I filled the song with everything I wished I could teach him about life. I tried to reassure him with every line about how the world is hard and unfair sometimes, but that it's all okay because he is so loved. He is surrounded by souls who would do anything to help him. And not only that, he has wisdom and patience of his own buried deep inside his being, which will only reveal themselves over time and will always carry him through any trial. He is a gift from God to all of us. I told him this fact through this old Sanskrit scripture, and I soon noticed that I was weeping cool tears. But before I could wipe the tears away, the Guru Gita was over. The hour and a half was finished. It felt like 10 minutes had passed. I realized what had happened, that Nikki had carried me through it. The little soul I'd wanted to help had actually been helping me. I walked to the front of the temple and bowed flat on my face in gratitude to my God, to the revolutionary power of love, to myself, to my guru, and to my nephew, briefly understanding on a molecular level, not an intellectual level, that there was no difference whatsoever between any of these words or any of these ideas or any of these people. Then I slid into the meditation cave where I skipped breakfast and sat for almost 2 hours, humming with stillness. Needless to say, I never missed the Guru Gita again, and it became the most holy of my practices at the ashram. Of course, Richard from Texas went to great lengths to tease me about having jumped out of the dormitory, being sure to say to me every night after dinner, "See you at the gate tomorrow morning, groceries. And hey, try using the stairs this time, okay?" And of course I called my sister the next week, and she said that, for reasons nobody could understand, Nick suddenly wasn't having trouble falling asleep anymore. And naturally, I was reading in the library a few days later from a book about the Indian saint Sri Ramakrishna, and I stumbled upon a story about a seeker who once came to see the great master and admitted to him that she feared she was not a good enough devotee, feared that she did not love God enough. And the saint said, "Is there nothing you love?" The woman admitted that she adored her young nephew more than anything on earth. The saint said, "There, then, he is your Krishna, your beloved. In your service to your nephew, you are serving God." But all this is inconsequential. The really amazing thing happened the same day I jumped out of the building. That afternoon, I ran into Delia, my roommate. I told her that she had padlocked me into our room. She was aghast. She said, "I can't imagine why I would have done that, especially because you'd been on my mind all morning. I had this really vivid dream about you last night. I haven't been able to stop thinking about it all day." "Tell me," I said. "I dreamt that you were on fire," Delia said, "and that your bed was on fire, too. I jumped up to try to help you, but by the time I got there, you were nothing but white ash." 55. It was then I decided I needed to stay here at the ashram. This was so totally not my original plan. My original plan had been to stay here for just 6 weeks, have a bit of transcendental experience, then continue traveling all over India, looking for God. I had maps and guidebooks and hiking boots and everything. I had specific temples and mosques and holy men I was all lined up to meet. I mean, it's India. There's so much to see and experience here. I've got a lot of mileage to cover, temples to explore, elephants and camels to ride, and I'd be devastated to miss the Ganges, the great Rajasthani desert, the nutty Mumbai movie houses, the Himalayas, the old tea plantations, the Calcutta rickshaws racing each other in the streets like the chariot scene from Ben-Hur. And I was even planning on meeting the Dalai Lama in March up in Dharamsala. I was hoping he could teach me about God. But to stay put? To immobilize myself in a small ashram in a tiny little village in the middle of nowhere? No, this was not my plan. On the other hand, the Zen masters always say that you cannot see your reflection in running water, only in still water. So something was telling me it would be spiritually negligent to run off now, when so much was happening right here in this small cloistered place where every minute of the day is organized to facilitate self-exploration and devotional practice. Did I really need to get on a bunch of trains and pick up intestinal parasites and hang around backpackers right now? Couldn't I do that later? Couldn't I meet the Dalai Lama some other time? Won't the Dalai Lama always be there? And if he should die, heaven forbid, won't they just find another one? Don't I already have a passport that looks like a tattooed circus lady? Is more travel really going to bring me any closer to revelatory contact with divinity? I didn't know what to do. I spent a day wavering over the decision. As usual, Richard from Texas had the last word. "Stay put, groceries," he said. "Forget about sightseeing. You got the rest of your life for that. You're on a spiritual journey, baby. Don't cop out and go only halfway to your potential. You got a personal invitation from God here. You're really going to turn that away?" "But what about all those beautiful things to see in India?" I asked. "Isn't it kind of a pity to travel halfway around the world just to stay in a little ashram the whole time?" "Groceries, baby, listen to your friend Richard. You go set your lily-white ass down in that meditation cave every day for the next 3 months, and I promise you this. You're going to start seeing some stuff that's so damn beautiful it'll make you want to throw rocks at the Taj Mahal." 56. Here's what I caught myself thinking about in meditation this morning. I was wondering where I should live once this year of traveling has ended. I don't want to move back to New York just out of reflex. Maybe a new town instead. Austin is supposed to be nice, and Chicago has all that beautiful architecture. Horrible winters, though. Or maybe I'll live abroad. I've heard good things about Sydney. If I lived somewhere cheaper than New York, maybe I could afford an extra bedroom, and then I could have a special meditation room. That'd be nice. I could paint it gold. Or maybe a rich blue. No, gold. No, blue. Finally, noticing this train of thought, I was aghast. I thought, here you are in India in an ashram in one of the holiest pilgrimage sites on earth, and instead of communing with the divine, you're trying to plan where you'll be meditating a year from now in a home that doesn't even exist yet in a city yet to be determined? How about this, you spastic fool? How about you try to meditate right here, right now, right where you actually are? I pulled my attention back to the silent repetition of the mantra. A few moments later, I paused to take back that mean comment about calling myself a spastic fool. I decided maybe that wasn't very loving. Still, I thought in the next moment, a gold meditation room would be nice. I opened my eyes and sighed. Is this really the best I can do? So that evening, I tried something new. I'd recently met a woman at the ashram who'd been studying Vipassana meditation. Vipassana is an ultra-orthodox, stripped-down, and very intensive Buddhist meditation technique. Basically, it's just sitting. An introductory Vipassana course lasts for 10 days, during which time you sit for 10 hours a day in stretches of silence that last 2 to 3 hours at a time. It's the extreme sports version of transcendence. Your Vipassana master won't even give you a mantra. This is considered a kind of cheating. Vipassana meditation is the practice of pure regarding, witnessing your mind and offering your complete consideration to your thought patterns, but allowing nothing to move you from your seat. It's physically grueling, too. You are forbidden to shift your body at all once you have been seated, no matter how severe your discomfort. You just sit there and tell yourself, there's no reason I need to move at all during the next 2 hours. If you're feeling discomfort, then you're supposed to meditate upon that discomfort, watching the effects that physical pain has on you. In our real lives, we are constantly hopping around to adjust ourselves around discomfort, physical, emotional, and psychological, in order to evade the reality of grief and nuisance. Vipassana meditation teaches that grief and nuisance are inevitable in this life, but if you can plant yourself in stillness long enough, you will, in time, experience the truth that everything, both uncomfortable and lovely, does eventually pass. The world is afflicted with death and decay, therefore the wise do not grieve, knowing the terms of the world, says an old Buddhist teaching. In other words, get used to it. I don't think Vipassana is necessarily the path for me. It's far too austere for my notions of devotional practice, which generally revolve around compassion and love and butterflies and bliss and a friendly God, what my friend Darcy calls slumber party theology. There isn't even any talk about God in Vipassana, since the notion of God is considered by some Buddhists to be the final object of dependency, the ultimate fuzzy security blanket, the last thing to be abandoned on the path to pure detachment. Now, I have my own personal issues with the very word detachment, having met spiritual seekers who already seem to live in a state of complete emotional disconnect from other human beings, and who, when they talk about the sacred pursuit of detachment, make me want to shake them and holler, buddy, that is the last thing you need to practice. Still, I can see where cultivating a measure of intelligent detachment in your life can be a valuable instrument of peace. And after reading about Vipassana meditation in the library one afternoon, I get to thinking about how much time I spend in my life crashing around like a great gasping fish, either squirming away from some uncomfortable distress or flopping hungrily toward ever more pleasure. And I wondered whether it might serve me and those who are burdened with the task of loving me if I could learn to stay still and endure a bit more without always getting dragged along the potholed road of circumstance. All these questions came back to me this evening when I found a quiet bench in one of the ashram gardens and decided to sit in meditation for an hour, Vipassana style. No movement, no agitation, not even mantra, just pure regarding. Let's see what comes up. Unfortunately, I had forgotten about what comes up at dusk in India. Mosquitoes. As soon as I sat down on that bench in the lovely gloaming, I could hear the mosquitoes coming at me, brushing against my face and landing in a group assault on my head, ankles, arms, and then their fierce little burns. I didn't like this. I thought, this is a bad time of day to practice Vipassana meditation. On the other hand, when is it a good time of day or life to sit in detached stillness? When isn't there something buzzing about, trying to distract you and get a rise out of you? So I made a decision, inspired again by my guru's instruction that we are to become scientists of our own inner experience. I presented myself with an experiment. What if I sat through this for once? Instead of slapping and griping, what if I sat through the discomfort just for 1 hour of my long life? So I did it. In stillness, I watched myself get eaten by mosquitoes. To be honest, part of me was wondering what this little macho experiment was meant to prove, but another part of me well knew it was a beginner's attempt at self-mastery. If I could sit through this non-lethal physical discomfort, then what other discomforts might I someday be able to sit through? What about emotional discomforts, which are even harder for me to endure? What about jealousy, anger, fear, disappointment, loneliness, shame, boredom? The itch was maddening at first, but eventually it just melded into a general burning feeling, and I rode that heat to a mild euphoria. I allowed the pain to lose its specific associations and become pure sensation, neither good nor bad, just intense. And that intensity lifted me out of myself and into meditation. I sat there for 2 hours. A bird might very well have landed on my head. I wouldn't have noticed. Let me be clear about one thing. I recognize that this experiment wasn't the most stoic act of fortitude in the history of mankind, and I'm not asking for a Congressional Medal of Honor here, but there was something mildly thrilling for me about realizing that in my 34 years on Earth, I have never not slapped at a mosquito when it was biting me. I've been a puppet to this and to millions of other small and large signals of pain or pleasure throughout my life. Whenever something happens, I always react. But here I was, disregarding the reflex. I was doing something I'd never done before. A small thing, granted. But how often do I get to say that? And what will I be able to do tomorrow that I cannot yet do today? When it was all over, I stood up, walked to my room, and assessed the damage. I counted about 20 mosquito bites. But within a half an hour, all of the bites had diminished. It all goes away. Eventually, everything goes away. 57. The search for God is a reversal of the normal, mundane, worldly order. In the search for God, you revert from what attracts you and you swim toward that which is difficult. You abandon your comforting and familiar habits with the hope, the mere hope, that something greater will be offered to you in return for what you've given up. Every religion in the world operates on the same common understandings of what it means to be a good disciple. Get up early and pray to your God. Hone your virtues, be a good neighbor, respect yourself and others, master your cravings. We all agree that it would be easier to sleep in, and many of us do, but for millennia, there have been others who choose instead to get up before the sun and wash their faces and go to their prayers, and then fiercely try to hold on to their devotional convictions through the lunacy of another day. The devout of this world perform their rituals without guarantee that anything good will ever come of it. Of course, there are plenty of scriptures and plenty of priests who will make plenty of promises as to what your good works will yield, or threats as to the punishments awaiting you if you lapse. But even to believe all this is an act of faith, because nobody amongst us is shown the end game. Devotion is diligence without assurance. Faith is a way of saying, yes, I pre-accept the terms of the universe, and I embrace in advance what I am presently incapable of understanding. There's a reason we refer to leaps of faith, because the decision to consent to any notion of divinity is a mighty jump from the rational over to the unknowable, and I don't care how diligently scholars of every religion will try to sit you down with their stacks of books and prove to you through scripture that their faith is indeed rational. It isn't. If faith were rational, it wouldn't be, by definition, faith. Faith is belief in what you cannot see or prove or touch. Faith is walking face first and full speed into the dark. If we truly knew all the answers in advance as to the meaning of life and the nature of God and the destiny of our souls, our belief would not be a leap of faith, and it would not be a courageous act of humanity. It would just be a prudent insurance policy. I'm not interested in the insurance industry. I'm tired of being a skeptic. I'm irritated by spiritual prudence, and I feel bored and parched by empirical debate. I don't want to hear it anymore. I couldn't care less about evidence and proof and assurances. I just want God. I want God inside me. I want God to play in my bloodstream the way sunlight amuses itself on water. 58. My prayers are becoming more deliberate and specific. It has occurred to me that it's not much use to send prayers out to the universe that are lazy. Every morning before meditation, I kneel in the temple and talk for a few minutes to God. I found during the beginning of my stay here at the ashram that I was often dull-witted during those divine conversations. Tired, confused, and bored, my prayers sounded the same. I remember kneeling down one morning, touching my forehead to the floor, and muttering to my Creator, I don't know what I need, but you must have some ideas, so just do something about it, would you? Similar to the way I have oftentimes spoken to my hairdresser. And I'm sorry, but that's a little lame. You can imagine God regarding that prayer with an arched eyebrow and sending back this message. Call me again when you decide to get serious about this. Of course God already knows what I need. The question is, do I know? Casting yourself at God's feet in helpless desperation is all well and good. Heaven knows I've done it myself plenty of times. But ultimately, you're likely to get more out of the experience if you can take some action on your end. There's a wonderful old Italian joke about a poor man who goes to church every day and prays before a statue of a great saint, begging, "Dear saint, please, 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 give me the grace to win the lottery." This lament goes on for months. Finally, the exasperated statue comes to life, looks down at the begging man, and says in weary disgust, "My son, please, 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 buy a ticket." Prayer is a relationship. Half the job is mine. If I want transformation, but can't even be bothered to articulate what exactly I'm aiming for, how will it ever occur? Half the benefit of prayer is in the asking itself, in the offering of a clearly posed and well-considered intention. If you don't have this, all your pleas and desires are boneless, floppy, inert. They swirl at your feet in a cold fog and never lift. So now I take the time every morning to search myself for specificity about what I am truly asking for. I kneel there in the temple with my face on that cold marble for as long as it takes for me to formulate an authentic prayer. If I don't feel sincere, then I will stay there on the floor until I do. What worked yesterday doesn't always work today. Prayers can become stale and drone into the boring and familiar if you let your attention stagnate. In making an effort to stay alert, I am assuming custodial responsibility for the maintenance of my own soul. Destiny, I feel, is also a relationship, a play between divine grace and willful self-effort. Half of it you have no control over, half of it is absolutely in your hands, and your actions will show measurable consequence. Man is neither entirely a puppet of the gods, nor is he entirely the captain of his own destiny. He's a little of both. We gallop through our lives like circus performers balancing on two speeding side-by-side horses. One foot is on the horse called fate, the other on the horse called free will. And the question you have to ask every day is, which horse is which? Which horse do I need to stop worrying about because it's not under my control, and which do I need to steer with concentrated effort? There is so much about my fate that I cannot control, but other things do fall under my jurisdiction. There are certain lottery tickets I can buy, thereby increasing my odds of finding contentment. I can decide how I spend my time, whom I interact with, whom I share my body and life and money and energy with. I can select what I eat and read and study. I can choose how I'm going to regard unfortunate circumstances in my life, whether I will see them as curses or opportunities. And on the occasions when I can't rise to the most optimistic viewpoint because I'm feeling too damn sorry for myself, I can choose to keep trying to change my outlook. I can choose my words and the tone of voice in which I speak to others. And most of all, I can choose my thoughts. This last concept is a radically new idea for me. Richard from Texas brought it to my attention recently when I was complaining about my inability to stop brooding. He said, "Groceries, you need to learn how to select your thoughts just the same way you select what clothes you're going to wear every day. This is a power you can cultivate. If you want to control things in your life so bad, work on the mind. That's the only thing you should be trying to control. Drop everything else but that. Because if you can't learn to master your thinking, you're in deep trouble forever." On first glance, this seems a nearly impossible task. Control your thoughts instead of the other way around. But imagine if you could. This is not about repression or denial. Repression and denial set up elaborate games to pretend that negative thoughts and feelings are not occurring. What Richard is talking about is instead admitting to the existence of negative thoughts, understanding where they came from and why they arrived, and then, with great forgiveness and fortitude, dismissing them. This is a practice that fits hand in glove with any psychological work you do during therapy. You can use the shrink's office to understand why you have these destructive thoughts in the first place. You can use your spiritual exercises to help overcome them. It's a sacrifice to let them go, of course. It's a loss of old habits, comforting old grudges, and familiar vignettes. Of course, this all takes practice and effort. It's not a teaching that you can hear once and then expect to master immediately. It's constant vigilance, and I want to do it. I need to do it for my strength. Devo farmi le ossa is how they say it in Italian. I need to make my bones. So I've started being vigilant about watching my thoughts all day and monitoring them. I repeat this vow about 700 times a day. I will not harbor unhealthy thoughts anymore. Every time a diminishing thought arises, I repeat the vow. I will not harbor unhealthy thoughts anymore. The first time I heard myself say this, my inner ear perked up at the word harbor, which is a noun as well as a verb. A harbor, of course, is a place of refuge, a port of entry. I pictured the harbor of my mind, a little beat up, perhaps, a little storm-worn, but well-situated and with a nice depth. The harbor of my mind is an open bay, the only access to the island of myself, which is a young and volcanic island, yes, but fertile and promising. This island has been through some wars, it is true, but it is now committed to peace under a new leader, me, who has instituted new policies to protect the place. And now let the word go out across the seven seas, there are much, much stricter laws on the books about who may enter this harbor. You may not come here anymore with your hard and abusive thoughts, with your plague ships of thoughts, with your slave ships of thoughts, with your warships of thoughts. All these will be turned away. Likewise, any thoughts that are filled with angry or starving exiles, with malcontents and pamphleteers, mutineers and violent assassins, desperate prostitutes, pimps and seditious stowaways, you may not come here anymore either. Cannibalistic thoughts, for obvious reasons, will no longer be received. Even missionaries will be screened carefully for sincerity. This is a peaceful harbor, the entryway to a fine and proud island that is only now beginning to cultivate tranquility. If you can abide by these new laws, my dear thoughts, then you are welcome in my mind. Otherwise, I shall turn you all back toward the sea from whence you came. That is my mission, and it will never end. 59. I've made good friends with this 17-year-old Indian girl named Tulsi. She works with me, scrubbing the temple floors every day. Every evening, we take a walk through the gardens of the ashram and talk about God and hip-hop music, two subjects for which Tulsi feels equivalent devotion. Tulsi is just about the cutest little bookworm of an Indian girl you ever saw, even cuter since one lens of her specs, as she calls her eyeglasses, broke last week in a cartoonish spiderweb design, which hasn't stopped her from wearing them. Tulsi is so many interesting and foreign things to me at once, a teenager, a tomboy, an Indian girl, a rebel in her family, a soul who is so crazy about God that it's almost like she's got a schoolgirl crush on him. She also speaks a delightful lilting English, the kind of English you find only in India, which includes such colonial words as splendid and nonsense, and sometimes produces eloquent sentences like, "It is beneficial to walk on the grass in the morning when the dew has already been accumulated, for it lowers naturally and pleasantly the body's temperature." When I told her once that I was going to Mumbai for the day, Tulsi said, "Please stand carefully, as you will find there are many speeding buses everywhere." She's exactly half my age and practically half my size. Tulsi and I have been talking a lot about marriage lately during our walks. Soon she will turn 18, and this is the age when she will be regarded as a legitimate marriage prospect. It will happen like this. After her 18th birthday, she will be required to attend family weddings dressed in a sari, signaling her womanhood. Some nice amma, auntie, will come and sit beside her, start asking questions and getting to know her. "How old are you? What's your family background? What does your father do? What universities are you applying to? What are your interests? When is your birthday?" Next thing you know, Tulsi's dad will get a big envelope in the mail with a photo of this woman's grandson, who is studying computer sciences in Delhi, along with the boy's astrology charts and his university grades and the inevitable question, "Would your daughter care to marry him?" Tulsi says, "It sucks." But it means so much to the family to see their children wedded off successfully. Tulsi has an aunt who just shaved her head as a gesture of thanks to God because her oldest daughter, at the Jurassic age of 28, finally got married. And this was a difficult girl to marry off, too. She had a lot of strikes against her. I asked Tulsi what makes an Indian girl difficult to marry off, and she said there are any number of reasons. If she has a bad horoscope, if she's too old, if her skin is too dark, if she's too educated and you can't find a man with a higher position than hers, and this is a widespread problem these days because a woman cannot be more educated than her husband, or if she's had an affair with someone and the whole community knows about it, oh, it would be quite difficult to find a husband after that. I quickly ran through the list, trying to see how marriageable I would appear in Indian society. I don't know whether my horoscope is good or bad, but I'm definitely too old, and I'm way too educated, and my morals have been publicly demonstrated to be quite tarnished. I'm not a very appealing prospect. At least my skin is fair. I have only this in my favor. Tulsi had to go to another cousin's wedding last week, and she was saying, in a very un-Indian fashion, how much she hates weddings. All that dancing and gossip, all that dressing up. She would rather be at the ashram scrubbing floors and meditating. Nobody else in her family can understand this. Her devotion to God is way beyond anything they consider normal. Tulsi said, "In my family, they have already given up on me as being too different. I have established a reputation for being someone who, if you tell her to do one thing, will almost certainly do the other. I also have a temper, and I am not dedicated to my studies, except that now I will be, because now I'm going to college, and I can decide for myself what I'm interested in. I want to study psychology, just as our guru did when she attended college. I'm considered a difficult girl. I have a reputation for needing to be told a good reason to do something before I will do it. My mother understands this about me and always tries to give good reasons, but my father doesn't. He gives reasons, but I don't think they are good enough. Sometimes I wonder what I'm doing in my family because I don't resemble them at all." Tulsi's cousin, who got married last week, is only 21, and her older sister is next on the marriage list at 20, which means that there will be huge pressure after that for Tulsi herself to find a husband. I asked her if she wanted to ever get married, and she said, "No," and the word drew out longer than the sunset we were watching over the gardens. "I want to roam," she said, "like you." "You know, Tulsi, I couldn't always roam like this. I was married once." She frowned at me through her cracked specs, studying me with a quizzical look, almost as if I'd just told her I'd once been a brunette and she was trying to imagine it. In the end, she pronounced, "You? Married? I cannot picture this." "But it's true, I was." "Are you the one who ended the marriage?" "Yes." She said, "I think it's most commendable that you ended your marriage. You seem splendidly happy now. But as for me, how did I get here? Why was I born an Indian girl? It's outrageous. Why did I come into this family? Why must I attend so many weddings?" Then Tulsi ran around in a frustrated circle, shouting quite loudly for ashram standards, "I want to live in Hawaii!" 60. Richard from Texas was married once, too. He had two sons, both of whom are grown men now, both close to their dad. Sometimes Richard mentions his ex-wife in some anecdote or another, and he always seems to speak of her with fondness. I get a bit envious whenever I hear this, imagining how lucky Richard is to still be friends with his former spouse even after separating. This is an odd side effect of my terrible divorce. Whenever I hear of couples splitting amicably, I get jealous. It's worse than that. I've actually come to think that it's really romantic when a marriage ends civilly. Like, oh, how sweet. They must have really loved each other. So I asked Richard one day about it. I said, it seems like you have fond feelings toward your ex-wife. Are you two still close? Nah, he said casually. She thinks that changed my name to motherfucker. Richard's lack of concern about this impressed me. My own ex-spouse happens to think that I changed my name too, and it breaks my heart. One of the hardest things about this divorce was the fact that my ex-husband never forgave me for leaving. That it didn't matter how many bushels of apologies or explanations I laid at his feet, how much blame I assumed, or how many assets or acts of contrition I was willing to offer him in exchange for departing. He was certainly never going to congratulate me and say, hey, I was so impressed with your generosity and honesty, and I just want to tell you, it's been a great pleasure being divorced by you. No. I was unredeemable, and this unredeemed dark hole was still inside me, even in moments of happiness and excitement, especially in moments of happiness and excitement. I could never forget it for long. I am still hated by him. And that felt like it would never change, never release. I was talking about all this one day with my friends at the ashram, the newest member of whom is a plumber from New Zealand, a guy I'd met because he heard I was a writer and he sought me out to tell me that he was one too. He's a poet who had recently published a terrific memoir in New Zealand called A Plumber's Progress about his own spiritual journey. The plumber poet from New Zealand, Richard from Texas, the Irish dairy farmer, Tulsi, the Indian teenage tomboy, and Vivian, an older woman with wispy white hair and incandescently humorous eyes who used to be a nun in South Africa, this was my circle of close friends here, a most vibrant crowd of characters whom I never would have expected to meet at an ashram in India. So during lunch one day, we were all having this conversation together about marriage, and the plumber poet from New Zealand said, I see marriage as an operation that sews two people together, and divorce is a kind of amputation that can take a long time to heal. The longer you are married, or the rougher the amputation, the harder it is to recover. Which would explain the post-divorce, post-amputation sensations I've had for a few years now, of still swinging that phantom limb around, constantly knocking stuff off the shelves. Richard from Texas was wondering if I was planning on allowing my ex-husband to dictate for the rest of my life how I felt about myself, and I said I wasn't too sure about that, actually. So far, my ex still seemed to have a pretty strong vote, and to be honest, I was still halfway waiting for the man to forgive me, to release me, and allow me to go forth in peace. The dairy farmer from Ireland observed, "Waiting for that day to arrive is not exactly a rational use of your time." What can I say, guys? I do a lot with guilt. Kind of like the way other women do a lot with beige. The former Catholic nun, who ought to know about guilt after all, wouldn't hear of it. Guilt is just your ego's way of tricking you into thinking you're making moral progress. Don't fall for it, my dear. What I hate about the way my marriage ended, I said, is that it's so unresolved. It's just an open wound that never goes away. If you insist, said Richard, if that's how you've decided to think about it, don't let me spoil your party. One of these days this has to end, I said. I just wish I knew how. When lunch ended, the plumber poet from New Zealand slipped me a note. It said to meet him after dinner. He wanted to show me something. So after dinner that night, I met him over by the meditation caves, and he told me to follow him, that he had a gift for me. He walked me across the ashram, then led me to a building I'd never been inside before, unlocked a door, and took me up a back set of stairs. He knew of this place, I guessed, because he fixes all the air conditioning units. Some of them are located up there. At the top of the stairs, there was a door, which he had to unlock with a combination. He did this swiftly, from memory. Then, we were up on a gorgeous rooftop, tiled in ceramic chips that glittered in the evening twilight like the bottom of a reflecting pool. He took me across that roof to a little tower, a minaret, really, and showed me another narrow set of stairs leading to the tippity top of the tower. He pointed to the tower and said, "I'm going to leave you now. You're going to go up there. Stay up there until it's finished." "Until what's finished?" I asked. The plumber just smiled, handed me a flashlight for getting down safely when it's over, and also handed me